The headlines: Iran's president says a new U.S. administration needs to abide by UN Resolution 2231 endorsing the Iran nuclear deal. The European Commission launches a new strategy to combat the new variants of COVID-19 amid mounting criticism of the EU's slow vaccination program. And fresh protests erupt in Myanmar against the February 1st military coup amid a heavy-handed crackdown by the junta. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in the Iranian capital, Tehran, this is World News. Our top story: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has called on the United States to make up for the mistakes of the previous administration.
The American nation and the current administration there have realized that Trump was wrong. We hope that those mistakes are compensated as soon as possible, and the current U.S. administration abides by the law, regulations, and UN Resolution 2231.
Rouhani said it's no shame to abide by the law, adding that the Iranian nation will never bow to U.S. bullying. He said all Iran wants from the U.S. is to show respect to international law and agreements. The Iranian president added that he hopes a change in Washington's policy so that Iran can have better relations with the rest of the world, especially in the trade sector. Despite his repeated pledges to come back to the 2015 nuclear deal, U.S. President Joe Biden has so far failed either to rejoin the international accord or lift anti-Iran sanctions imposed by his predecessor. Political commentator Heinz Gertner says the basis for any talks between the parties to the Iran nuclear deal should be UN Resolution 2231.
Of course, the basis for further talks and a common denominator be the UN Resolution 2231. That's international law, and everybody has to abide by it, and the United States and the other UN powers as well as agree to it. So that could be the basis, and the substance should be to return, of course, to the original GCPOA. The most important thing what they should discuss is that the Europeans get more room of maneuver, that the U.S. should do away, should cancel the secondary sanctions which threaten European companies who wants to do business with Iran. So it gives the Europeans more leeway to act proactively, to maybe also to take the lead as they did already in before the GCPOA was negotiated.
The European Commission has launched a new strategy designed to combat the new mutations of the coronavirus. The move comes amid mounting criticism of the bloc's slow vaccination program. Jerome Hughes reports.
The latest available data suggests only 4.8% of EU citizens have so far been vaccinated against COVID-19. Frustration levels are growing because it is not yet clear when people living in the 27-nation bloc can expect to receive the jab.
Of course, everybody needs to speed up. All the countries, France, Belgium, Germany, it's all hanging. We're all hanging around and just waiting.
For example, in France, for my grandparents, it's quite hard to get some appointment to have a dose.
We should speed up a little more and start vaccination a lot, vaccinate people a lot.
In hindsight, it turned out a bad decision that the EU was responsible, because the overall administration is so complex, it would have been easier to have this set up on a national level.
That widely held opinion is being rejected by the head of the European Commission.
With the purchasing power of 27, we were able to agree on this enormous volume I've just described, 2.3 billion doses.
So where are these doses? Experts say the reason the UK and US are way ahead of the EU on vaccination is because the European Commission was too slow to sign contracts with producers, and approval to use the jabs is also a sluggish process.
Mass vaccination centres like this one in Brussels are popping up right across the European Union. On the face of it, that sounds like a great thing. The problem is they are practically empty due to vaccine supply issues.
The European Commission has just launched a plan designed to detect variants of the disease earlier and share this information across the EU. The problem is that mutations are allowed to form when large numbers of people are not vaccinated.
We are ready to go one step further and to propose an emergency authorization of vaccines at EU level with shared liability among us, if there's a decision by the European leaders to move in this direction.
The economic consequences for the EU of this slow vaccines rollout are almost immeasurable. The political consequences for the project might prove fatal, according to some analysts. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The European aircraft giant Airbus has reported a net loss of $1.3 billion in 2020 due to plunging deliveries amid the COVID-19 crisis. The plane maker says it was able to limit the damage despite the collapse of the aviation sector due to the pandemic. The company predicts flat 2021 deliveries and a core operating profit of $2.4 billion. This year, Airbus has recently overtaken U.S. rival Boeing to become the world's largest jet maker. The airline sector collapsed last year after most flights were cancelled and strict lockdowns were imposed in countries around the globe. The death toll has risen to 37 as an unprecedented cold blast is wreaking havoc in parts of the United States over the past 6 days. A deadly winter storm has brought snow and freezing rain to the southeast, causing power outage and water shortages. More than 100 million people are under winter weather alerts extending from Texas to New England. The cold spell is also expected to bring perilous travel conditions from the country's south central to the east coast. According to the National Weather Service, flash floods have also hit some 16 million people in the southeast, including Atlanta and Raleigh. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent Wyatt Reed says there has been no word from American officials on when electricity will be restored to millions of people suffering from the cold blast.
Millions are continuing to struggle and suffer without access to power. Still no real word on when it will be restored for millions of Texans. The major metropolitan areas, Dallas, San Antonio, Dallas-Fort Worth, Houston, Austin, all of these cities have been massively, massively affected. San Antonio has their capacity in terms of ambulances totally overwhelmed. Cities like Galveston are calling for refrigerated trucks to carry the bodies, which they expect to find in the coming days inside these houses that have no access to heat. Folks really struggling sort of to create any sort of heat that they can by doing unadvisable things like warming themselves in their cars, in their garages. Hundreds have been injured with carbon monoxide poisoning from doing this.
A new poll indicates that a legacy of the 2020 election in the United States may be a rejection of the two mainstream political parties. For the first time ever, a top pollster has found that half of the country now identifies as an independent, while support for a third party is also at a record high. Rami Mazari has more from Chicago.
Following the bitterly disputed 2020 election campaign, top pollster Gallup has found that support for third parties is at its highest point ever in the United States. 62% of people agree that a third party is needed because Democrats and Republicans, quote, do such a poor job representing the American people. Another polling record was also recorded. The number of Americans who identify as an independent is now at 50%.
And everybody's tired of it. Everybody is fed up with the hypocrisy and ineffectiveness of the Democrats in the terms that they claim to want to be effective. I think they're actually very effective in what they're actually doing. And the Republicans, of course, you know, they have one program, which is tax cuts for the rich.
Ex-President Donald Trump, who remains banned from top U.S. social media, issued a rare statement which attacked top Republican leadership. That's being interpreted as a sign that he may stay within the mainstream and try to make so-called Trumpism the undisputed platform of the Republican Party. However, there is much speculation that Trump will start a new third party. Polls say a Trump-led third party would attract not just two-thirds of Republicans, but also 30% of independents and even 15% of Democrats. The party would push Republicans into third place, ushering in a new era of multi-party plurality and ending what is probably the world's oldest political duopoly.
Certainly those people are out there ready for the picking for a third party that they perceive as A, fighting for things that are important to their daily lives, and B, treating them with respect and not treating them as, you know, you're racist and fascist and you know, sexist and whatever.
Trump won in 2016 by running as a so-called outsider candidate, and while he is unemployed 4 years later, rejection of the two mainstream parties is now the majority sentiment. The most popular third parties currently in the U.S. are the Libertarians, who are associated with a strong demand for individualism, the Greens, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the Alliance Party, a coalition for independence. Those parties combined for under 2% of the 2020 presidential vote. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Anti-coup protesters have once again taken to the streets of Myanmar to demand an end to the military takeover despite an intensified crackdown on protests. Protesters filled the streets of the country's commercial hub, Yangon. They chanted slogans against the coup and called for the release of de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and other civilian politicians. Similar rallies were also held in a number of other cities. The Southeast Asian nation has been the scene of street protests since the military seized power on February the 1st over the alleged voter fraud in November elections. According to a political prisoners monitoring group, nearly 500 people have been arrested. On Wednesday, security forces also opened fire on railway workers taking part in a civil disobedience movement in the city of Mandalay.
Myanmar has been the scene of mass demonstrations against junta leaders ever since the February 1 coup. Anti-coup protesters have defied a crackdown by the military, taking to the streets in several cities across the country almost daily. Demonstrators are demanding the release of the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, who was detained along with a number of parliament members. They're also demanding the restoration of civilian rule. Myanmar's junta has ratcheted up security measures to quell anti-coup demonstrations, and the internet in Yangon has been down for several days. Junta leaders deny they staged a coup and justified their power seizure by alleging widespread voter fraud in November elections that Suu Kyi's party won. They also pledged to hold new elections soon. This, however, has failed to calm down the situation.
I guess a lot of times, with the Burma army and the Burmese dictators, they are always above the law. So why he doesn't calm the situation is because he doesn't want to calm the situation, because he wants things to be under his control, and he wanted to hold on to the power the way he wants to run the country. And that is why, although you will see a lot of chaotic going on, and you would think that if he is sincere about, if he's talking about the election issues and election is fraud, if that is the case, then why violence?
The army generals have filed multiple charges against the deposed leader, including ignoring an import and export law over walkie-talkies that were found in her home during a search. The Nobel laureate's lawyer says she has also been hit with a second charge, which is violating the country's disaster management law. Observers believe the accusations against Suu Kyi are an indication that the military is seeking a permanent grip on power.
Nobody knows how long the military is going to hold on to the power, but it is very worrisome that they probably may not want to let go the power because for so many reasons, especially those who are in power, like high-ranking position like Mae Aung Lee. He has so much political ambition in order to become the president, and even more so in order to control and have control over his own economic ambitions.
Myanmar's military rule began in 1962. It came to an end in 2011 following elections a year earlier. The vote led to the formation of a civilian government, but now the country is back under military rule following the army's coup on February the 1st. Now the question is, has a recent putsch hindered the country's push for democratic rule? The military says it has staged the coup over voter fraud in general elections held in November. It says more than 8 million cases of fraud have been uncovered. Myanmar's coup has in the meantime raised fears that it could turn into a bone of contention between China and the U.S. The two powers have already been at odds over a range of issues.
The military seizure of power has drawn global reactions. The United Nations has warned the army of several consequences of any harsh response to protesters. The UN Special Rapporteur said Myanmar's generals will be held accountable for any suppression of the civil disobedience campaign there. The coup also drew reactions from other international players. China said the situation in Myanmar is not what Beijing wants to see. It also rejected social media rumors that China was involved in the coup as complete nonsense. However, China, along with Russia, says the coup is Myanmar's internal affair. The United States, however, has taken a different stance. Last Wednesday, US President Joe Biden announced new sanctions on those responsible for the coup and any entities linked to junta leaders. Biden said Washington will be ready to impose additional measures. There is also the risk of a new confrontation between US and China, maybe over Myanmar.
I mean, look, yes, the US is talking about threatening to impose sanctions, targeted sanctions especially. And what did they do in the past week? They did impose some targeted sanctions, but it's just on what, on the gems companies? But the most important thing to follow, to go behind, is the oil and gas company that is owned by the military. That is where they make a whole bunch of money in order to buy their submarines, their warplanes, all kinds of sophisticated weapons, which we call Mag and Mel, the oil company. They didn't do anything about it. That is something we wanted to see the U.S. will sanction.
The two nuclear-armed countries are already facing off on a range of other issues, including the U.S. interference in China's periphery, such as the South China Sea and the Korean Peninsula, as well as the trade and cyber wars between them. Myanmar is just another geopolitical war threat for China and the U.S., but observers believe Beijing has an edge over Washington in this struggle.
Russia slammed as unacceptable a ruling by the European Court of Human Rights that calls on Russia to release opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Kremlin said the ruling amounted to meddling in its domestic affairs. On Wednesday, the Strasbourg-based court asked Russia to immediately release Navalny, saying his life is in danger in prison. The ECHR also warned that Russia's failure to release the Kremlin critic would mark a breach of the European Human Rights Convention. The ruling infuriated Moscow. The Russian justice minister called the demand unlawful, adding that there are no legal grounds for Navalny's release. Moscow-Brussels ties have been strained over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his detention on his return from Germany. Navalny was sentenced to nearly 3 years in jail for violating a 2014 parole. The United States has approved a nearly $200 million arms sale to Egypt amid reports of human rights violations in the Arab country. The U.S. State Department described Egypt as an important strategic partner in the Middle East, adding that the sale was a routine replenishment of naval missiles. Egyptian authorities on Sunday detained relatives of Egyptian-American human rights activist Mohammed Sultan, who was jailed for nearly 2 years before being released in 2015. The U.S. State Department said Washington is looking into reports of the detentions, adding that Washington takes seriously all allegations of arbitrary arrest or detention. An official from Human Rights Watch said the repression under Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi should have already stopped Egypt from receiving U.S. arms. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a televised speech delivered on January 8, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, on the anniversary of an uprising led by the people of the city of Qom on January 9, 1978.
I deem it necessary to mention the names of Shahid Soleimani's team. This is because Shahid Soleimani's greatness caused their names to be mentioned less frequently. Shahid Pour Jafri, Shahid Muzaffariniya, Shahid Tarami, and Shahid Zamaniniya, all of whom were among outstanding martyrs. I deem it necessary to speak about Shahid Abu Mahdi's companions as well, but I do not have their names in my mind. Also, I deem it necessary to mention the martyrs who lost their lives in the burial ceremony of Shahid Soleimani in Kerman, and also the casualties of the very bitter and sad airplane incident, which was really a bitter and unpleasant incident that caused the country mourn for their loss. I hope that Allah the Exalted will bestow His mercy and blessings on those martyrs, whether the Kerman or the Tehran martyrs, and will shower patience and tranquility on their families with His grace and kindness. Of course, officials have certain duties in their regard, and they have been reminded of them.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Moreover, I find it necessary to commemorate the memory of Shahid Fakhrizadeh on the occasion of his 40-day martyrdom commemoration. He was an outstanding martyr and a great personality. Recently, we lost two great scientific personalities. One was Shahid Fakhrizadeh and the other was Ayatollah Misbah Yazdi. Both were great scientific personalities, each within the scope of their work and their area. Both have left valuable legacies in the organizations where they were active, and therefore, these legacies should definitely be preserved in the best way possible by Allah's favor. As for the 19th of Day uprising, according to solar calendar, I wish to raise two points. One is that we need to protect the memory of that event, and another is that we should preserve and guard its content and meaning. In other words, we need to protect the event itself in the sense that we are obliged to keep it alive, and also we need to protect the content of that great epic.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
To Allah.
The Israeli military has once again carried out a number of missile attacks from the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, targeting several army positions near the capital Damascus. The Syrian media have confirmed the attacks, saying Israeli jets flew over the Golan Heights to hit targets on the edge of Damascus. They also said the country's air defense intercepted and shut down most of the missiles fired toward Damascus. But this is not the first time the regime attacks Syria. Israel has done hundreds of air and missile strikes on government troops and their allies there. Some believe the attacks are aimed at undermining the country's military capabilities.
This has been the focus for the last few years. Israel's focus especially has been towards Syria's air defense systems. I don't think they have been successful, however, because clearly Syrian air defense systems are working well and better than they did at the start of the war. Most of Israel's missiles have been shot down.
The Israeli attacks against Syria have been going on ever since the country was gripped by foreign-backed militancy in March 2011. The Syrian government forces have already clawed back much of the territory it lost to terrorist groups in the first couple of years of the Syrian conflict. Syrian troops are now engaged in a few mopping-up operations to clear the country from the remnants of Takfiri terror groups. The Syrian government says the Israeli regime and its Western and regional allies are aiding Takfiris that reduced large swathes of Syria to rubble.
Well, the U.S. is continuing their four-decade, you know, tradition of supporting terrorism in the region. They continue to fund the White Helmets, which, as we know, is Al-Qaeda with white hats on, in Idlib province. They continue to try to extend the conflict in the northwest of Syria, where Al-Qaeda has taken over the entirety of Idlib province. And they admit that Al-Qaeda is the biggest force in that region. And they want to maintain or continue that war for as long as possible by supporting Al-Qaeda.
Monday's attack on Syria comes as senior Israeli military officials have previously said that escalating attacks inside the Arab country are aimed at ending Iran's military presence there. This is while Iran says its military presence in Syria is upon a request from the Damascus government, adding that Tehran has not received any message demanding it leave Syria.
Of course, the Syrian government invited Iran to support Syria against the terrorist and Zionist attack. Syria and Iran have been allies for decades. And of course, this is also in Iran's interest, because those terrorists will eventually try to attack within Iran. And of course, the whole point of the war is to, why the U.S. caused the war in the first place is for Israel's sake, and that is to try to create a new government in Syria that would not be allied to Iran. They're trying to break up the Syrian-Iranian alliance.
Damascus has sent many letters of protest to the UN to demand a world body end the Israeli aggression. So far, to no avail.
Well, Israel continuously is breaking international law by breaching Syrian sovereignty. And we also know that they have done this for decades in Palestine. And the United Nations hasn't been able to do anything about it. They are now trying to take Israel to the International Criminal Court. And this is something that's been resisted by the U.S. and even Germany. So the problem with the United Nations is that at the end of the day, who controls what happens? It's the country that has the power, that has nuclear weapons. And therefore, the U.N. is a bit of a joke, because even if they were to condemn Israel for its crimes, which even that they're not able to do, they wouldn't be able to physically do anything to bring Israel to justice.
Many construe the West's silence towards continued Israeli attacks on Syria as tactical support for the aggression. They also attribute the escalation in the attacks to Israel's anger over the victory of Syria and the axis of resistance in the face of the years-long militancy against the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The militancy is widely seen as a foreign-backed plot to bring about regime change in Syria and partition it into weak states in favor of Israel's geostrategic interests. The militancy failed. Now Syria is nearly in full control of its territory and is on track towards stability.
Bahrainis have taken to the streets across the tiny Persian Gulf Kingdom to mark the 10th anniversary of the popular uprising against the ruling monarchy. The rallies took place on Saturday night on the eve of the 2011 uprising's anniversary, with the participants chanting slogans against the Al-Khalifa regime and King Hamad bin Isa Al-Khalifa. The protests were held in several towns and villages near the capital Manama. People called for an end to human rights violations and the release of political prisoners. The demonstrators carried pictures of the uprising's leaders and martyrs, as well as placards vowing resistance until victory.
They have waited for almost 100 years of struggle, 100 years of struggle since 1922 until now, and they put forward their demands clearly. They do not want this dictatorship. Now, of course, the situation has become even worse because the Khalifa dictators have become even more anti-people, against the people, with harsh policies, but also they have gone as far as the Arab and Muslim cause of Palestine, and they have normalized their relationship with the Israelis. The people are simply very angry. They just do not like that. They think this is betrayal, this is treachery.
They also blocked the streets by setting up bonfires despite heavy security and the presence of policemen. The protesters held handwritten posters with messages of solidarity with the families of the martyrs and condemnation of the regime's repression. Additionally, the Coalition Youth of the 14th February Revolution, in a statement, called on all Bahraini groups and masses to close ranks in order to change the ruling political regime in Manama. The Manama regime is pressing ahead with its heavy-handed crackdown and persecution of human rights campaigners and political dissidents, despite condemnations by the international community. Furthermore, the Al-Khalifa regime has begun trying civilians at military tribunals since 2017, a move that has drawn widespread condemnation from human rights bodies and activists and has been described as the imposition of an undeclared martial law across the country. The heavy-handed response saw scores of people dead, thousands arrested, and many tortured in custody over years. The unprecedented suppression drew international outcries. Emboldened by foreign support, the Manama regime dissolved the main opposition party Al-Wefaq in 2016 and put its leaders behind bars. Experts believe the ruling regime in Bahrain is committing such acts with impunity as it enjoys support from Saudi Arabia.
We also know that the Khalifis are receiving orders from the Saudis, from the Emiratis, and this is another problem. They have sold out the sovereignty of the country. We are not a sovereign state. We do not have our own political decisions. We have to follow them. The Emirates and the Saudis say we want to go and have relations with Israel. Yes, we have to. It is not a matter of discussion and debate. It is a matter of imposition and a matter of following, accepting whatever is being imposed from the outside.
But as Bahrain's most prominent Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, noted, the actions of the Al-Khalifa regime and the unwavering support of the Saudi military cannot undermine the determination of the Bahraini people, as a reactionary and cruel rule of the Bahraini regime is incompatible with the will of the people.
On September 11, 2001, Two hijacked airplanes were flown into the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City, resulting in the death of nearly 3,000 people. In the wake of terrorist attacks, the U.S. administration, led by then-President George W. Bush, declared a war on terror, arguing that the need to counter terrorism and people's safety overrides the obligation to respect human rights. With that incentive, the Guantanamo Bay Prison, also known as Gitmo, was established in southern Cuba in January 2002 to hold inmates in a place neither the U.S. nor international law applied. Since then, Guantanamo has been synonymous with human rights abuses perpetrated by the U.S. government in the name of terrorism. Since its establishment, the notorious prison has been under fire for the so-called enhanced interrogation methods used on inmates to force them to confess to crimes that they might not have even committed. Interrogation methods, which international human rights advocates say amounted to torture. Back in 2019, the New York Times published an article containing disturbing methods of torture on a prisoner named Abu Zubaida. It included methods like waterboarding, walling, and sleep deprivation. At its peak, over 750 inmates have been held in the facility since its establishment. However, based on an Amnesty International report, only seven have been convicted, including five as a result of pretrial agreements under which they pleaded guilty, returned for a possibility of being released from the base. Currently, 40 inmates are incarcerated in Guantanamo without any charges. They are stuck in a legal limbo, languishing there for nearly two decades. That is while the proceedings have been delayed at the pretrial stage for several years. That justifies why Guantanamo Bay Prison is a symbol of lingering U.S. injustice. Meanwhile, the conditions in the detention camp are deteriorating. According to a New York Times article following the tropical rains this summer and fall, raw sewage sloshed inside cells and toilets overflowed. Such unsanitary conditions become more alarming when we consider the potential impact on containing the spread of the coronavirus within the prison. Moreover, in late January, the Pentagon halted the plan to offer COVID-19 vaccinations to Guantanamo Bay prisoners. That has raised criticism from health experts and rights groups, as they say prisoners must be high on the priority list to get the vaccine because they are in close contact with the prison staff. With the prisoners stuck in legal limbo, deteriorating infrastructure, and international outcry against torture and injustice, why has the prison been allowed to continue to operate?
Well, it's only because of the power of the United States that it can continue to operate. It's clearly in violation of international law. And people are held without charge in many cases and held indefinitely. And we know that many, many, many hundreds and hundreds of people who were taken to Guantanamo were taken there because they had been turned in by enemies.
The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has launched a formal review of the offshore U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on Friday that Biden intends to close the controversial prison before leaving office, saying that it's a priority of the Biden administration. Closing the Guantanamo Bay prison was initially one of the campaign promises of former U.S. President Barack Obama, who had Joe Biden as his vice president by his side. However, despite being one of the first executive orders of Obama, after assuming office in 2009, he failed to realize this goal, once calling it a stain on U.S. record in upholding rules of law. His only achievement was transferring 197 inmates from the facility to either their home or third-party countries through a review board process. However, former President Donald Trump immediately reversed that policy as soon as he took office in 2017 and kept the controversial prison open during his 4 years in office. Trump's decision to resume rendition to Guantanamo Bay drew outrage from human rights groups who have long campaigned for its closure. That is why experts believe the new administration will encounter the same political and legal obstacles in shutting down the offshore prison as Obama did. Also, it seems the revival of this Obama-era policy is currently hampered by the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout.
I don't think there's any great reason to believe that Biden will push ahead. Biden's foreign policy objectives are very much against Iran, against China, against Venezuela and Cuba, maybe not using the same tactics as the Trump administration, but with the same objective in mind.
While an insane amount of $13 million a year for each prisoner is needed to keep the wheels of Guantanamo turning, and the negative impact it's having on America's global image, closing it would be a viable prospect. However, can Joe Biden manage to remove what human rights advocates call a stain on America's global image?
when Lujuan Al-Hathoul, a prominent woman's rights activist, sat in her car and drove into Saudi Arabia in 2014 using her valid UAE driving license. She was arrested and sent to jail, spending 73 days in a women's detention facility. This sparked her campaign to launch an attack against the archaic male-dominated guardianship system run by the Saudi regime. Yet it was in March 2018 when she was essentially forced out of the UAE and flown back to Riyadh and placed under house arrest before being moved to prison that saw her and other women's rights activists clamped down on by the Bin Salman regime. It hence raises the question that if the despotic Saudi crown prince Bin Salman is so keen on reforms, why then is he so quick to silence the women of his country, especially in the face of a simple and basic human rights demand, such as being able to drive a car?
In a sense, in his own mind, he's serious, but in terms of world image, he's not serious. His actions are very crude, to imprison someone that was not a physical threat of any kind. It seems to me that Lujain is really seen as a an exponent of Western human rights ideas.
Many from around the world have condemned the arrest of Al-Hathoul, with UN Special Rapporteur Agnes Callamard stating that the cruelty of Saudi Arabia rulers that kept her away from her family, her home, that violated her most basic right to physical and mental integrity, should not be forgotten, suggesting that even though she'd been released, the act by the Saudi regime should still be remembered. The global awareness group Human Rights Watch also celebrated the fact that Al-Hathoul had been released, with its director Ken Roth stating that he was happy that she'd been released, yet he reminded all that they must not forget the so-called reforms by Bin Salman and nothing more than a distraction of the real events happening in the kingdom. With Al-Hathoul now back home, what now remains to be seen is whether she will actually remain free or the Saudi regime, led by Bin Salman, continue to suppress Al-Hathoul and many more like her. They say that money can buy anything, and this is truer than ever when it comes to the Saudi regime. One only has to look at the way Bin Salman bought the silence of ex-US President Donald Trump following the murder of Jamal Khashoggi in Turkey. Therefore, are the messages of condemnation against the Saudi human rights simply a fake fanfare ignored by Riyadh at their leisure? With many activists in Saudi Arabia still languishing behind bars, the case of Al-Hathoul is just one of many, and as the Saudi regime continue to pump billions into the military arms complex of Western nations, are the condemnations echoed by the West simply double standards?
Well, of course it does, but Saudi Arabia has been the linchpin, really, of American Middle East policy, foreign policy. And in a sense, that ties in with world policy. If Saudi Arabia goes, there will be dominoes, a domino effect of other regimes, and it will leave Israel much more isolated.
One such example is the British government, who have recently agreed to authorise the sale of £1.9 billion worth of military equipment to the Saudi regime, whilst at the same time preaching to the world that human rights actually matter. Where then did the rights of the people of Yemen go in this statement? Yet for the British, the sale of arms and turning a blind eye to war crimes has come from necessity rather than security. As Brexit takes its toll on the British economy, the sale of arms is nothing more than an act of state begging, something that the Saudi regime are happy to toss a few coins into the outstretched British hand to buy their silence with. As Bin Salman attempts to use his so-called reforms to paint a false impression to the world that he is the saviour of change, the truth of the matter is that the image, the brand, and the goodwill shown by Bin Salman and his team is nothing more than a charade designed to fool the theatre audience into the Saudi divine comedy.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Oh.
is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to another edition of the program, Back to Reality, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and my dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, brothers. Welcome to the program.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Brother Yasir, always a pleasure to be with you on the show.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Mohsen Naqvi. Thanks for inviting to this program.
Welcome. Brother Yasir, let me start with you in this episode regarding social changes in people, especially as a result of social media. You know, we all know that when social networks came into the arena, when everyone was like familiar with some of these social networks, their life seemed to have been changed, right? Would you talk about some of these changes and have you been affected by them?
I'll give you one personal example of how social media actually not affect me, but it helped me. Mm-hmm. So there is positive in it. I was coming back and my bag got taken accidentally by someone else.
In airport
in Turkey. Uh-huh. So you have the carrier on top where you put your bags on top of the seats.
Yes.
So the person who took my bag had a similar bag to me.
Uh-huh.
So he didn't know because he was carrying that bag for somebody else. So my bag and his bag were very similar.
Very good.
So he took my bag. So I'm looking, where's my bag? So I take that one. So I don't know what to do. I said, it's not mine. So I took it.
Did you know that it was not yours?
I knew it wasn't mine.
Uh-huh.
But okay. He didn't, because he probably just took it quickly and he left off the plane.
Earlier than you.
So after a while, like maybe a couple of weeks later, what was in my bag was my university certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore it had my name on it. And when my name was on it, the person who took my bag found me on Facebook.
Nice.
He found me on Facebook. And so my wife was in the UK at the time. And I was just told to go on my Facebook and check. And there was a message there from this person. That, I have your bag. You have mine. You know, is there a way we can swap? So therefore, we exchanged numbers.
What was the person that?
He was from the UK. But he was traveling from Turkey to UK.
Uh-huh.
While I was traveling in the other way.
I see.
I was traveling from the UK back to Iran. So it got mixed up, and then a couple of weeks later we communicated via Facebook and stuff. So I told him, look, I'm coming to the UK in a couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. We can meet. So he said, fine. So he kept my bag, I kept his bag, I took his bag back. He came to my home, he picked it up, he gave mine anyway.
Nice. Have you become friends?
No, that was it. That was all the communication we had.
How strange.
Because it was just, that's the way it is, right? So one of the things that social media does, it brought back old friendships.
Right.
I remember, like, my dad met people he knew from university.
Mm.
And he lost contact with them, but he found them on Facebook.
Nice.
For example. So this happened, but...
Reunion.
There is, like, one of my teachers once said, and I'll end with this, is that, yes, we have been able to communicate easier, but we communicate less. Meaning what? Someone messages, okay, mm-hmm. Fine, thanks. The quality might be very low. But the quantity is, you know, so many different people at so many different times. But there's no depth in the communication with the person one to one or face to face. Exactly, because when you write a letter, back in the day, when you would write a letter, you knew that you had to write a lot because you're not going to get another chance in a few months for this letter to go get delivered and so on. So it required effort, it required you to think, you know, to put your imagination at play here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it created that. They strengthen the imagination. The social media is actually a detriment to the imagination if you think about it.
Yes.
You as yourself will know, as a person who studied this educational background you have, will know that if you just write something without even thinking about it, you knowing that it's going to be delivered immediately, you're not using your mind at all. Whereas you sit and write a letter and you think about it, it really, you know, what we call it, promotes that thought process.
Exactly. Brother Ali Mohsen, what do you think? Have social media changed your life?
Well, obviously it has changed a lot.
It changed everybody's life, yeah. So.
Let me hear his story.
He must have a story.
Well, obviously it has changed. I can imagine I can think of myself being in grade 9 or 10 in the school when my father first brought a mobile phone in the home, and it was very big, and it was
a walkie-talkie.
A walkie-talkie, yeah.
How many years ago was that?
It's around 1999, 2000.
Okay.
And that was the first time we saw a mobile phone. I was in Pakistan. And after that, he bought a small, tiny Samsung mobile, 3300. I hope that most of the listeners know that. 3300, how is it? Because they used to say it can be used for fighting as well, because it has a good case.
I see.
Like the
heavy
old
enough.
Car. Yes, heavy enough. And tiny as well, which can be fixed in the pocket. And today we can see each other on the mobile phones. And when I sit alone and I think about the social media and the advancements, the technological advancements that is happening with this social media, I don't know where my kids going to go, where they're going to be.
I see.
I cannot imagine at all, because my parents never imagined this thing, the situation that we are in.
Mm-hmm.
And I cannot imagine anything beyond this. So it's beyond my limits. And we need to sit and wait and see what happens in the future.
Yeah, there's always this generation gap when it comes
to change. It's a generation change.
Technology, exactly.
And it is also said scientifically, they say like every new generation is at least 15 years ahead the previous generation.
Exactly.
For example, my kids are at least 15 years ahead than me.
Mm-hmm.
So it's scientifical, obviously. There was a survey, they proved this. And it is somehow the reality as well, obviously, with this advancement that we have. Why all these advancements are, this is for entertaining people.
Mm-hmm.
If we think of less entertainment, maybe we can control the social media as well.
I see.
Because the social media is a mean of entertainment. Now we do not gather together, having a family, we can say gathering, maybe in the nights, having dinner together. For example, when I was working in UK, I asked one of my colleagues, because I was studying and working as well, so I was alone there. My family was back in Pakistan. But I asked one of my colleagues, like, how your day, like, how do you pass your day, your week? Do you see your family? He said, like, I see my dad once in a week and my mom maybe a fortnight. Once in a fortnight. And once in a month, somehow we get together to have a dinner or maybe a breakfast together. Because his father was working nighttime, his mother was working daytime, and he himself was going to the uni and working as well on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
So all the time, like, they were busy. And the only communication that they had were through the social media. So this lifestyle that we have now, obviously, social media has caused many things to be used in a positive way and in a negative way as well.
Right.
Both ways.
I see. Let me ask Brother Yasser Ibrahim about the nature of the media in this way that Brother Ali Mohsen talked about. Do you think that social media is a kind of double-edged sword?
I give you an example of television, because it's the same kind of line we're going through, right?
Yes.
When television...
The more traditional...
Forget television, radio even. Right, we have particular ulamas. When radio came, the first thing immediately is it's haram. But then when they used it, it's no. It can be used for good as well.
Mm-hmm.
Same with television. Same with the internet. Right? When you see that, no, yes, there's no doubt about it. Those who created it did not have this intention in mind. But it does not mean you cannot use it to betterment. And we see it today, for example.
This is what we are doing here.
Right now.
At this studio.
Exactly.
At this time.
Exactly. There's no doubt that, okay, you have a weapon that you did not create.
Mm-hmm.
I'm using the word weapon very loosely. But it is, the battlefield is this type of format right now. You have to use it. Unfortunately, alhamdulillah, you know, we are using it on, but it's not to say that we are making the most use of it.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely a double-edged sword. It can be used to completely deviate a person. But I'm sure, say myself, I know so many people who have found truth, who have found the path of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, just by the internet.
Yes.
Just by watching the news. Just by seeing something online that has, you know, flickered their interest.
Yes.
So it's no doubt about it. But the thing is that...
And lots of people converted to Islam through social media.
Exactly. Some people got married. They found a wife on Facebook, for example. A good wife. Not a proper Muslim. Because they were alone and they found this girl who was also alone. And
thanks to coronavirus.
Yeah. And thanks to coronavirus. And
they have to stay home.
Yeah.
Searching.
So they, alhamdulillah,
There must be a morality in the social media as well.
That's the issue. That's the problem. There is no moral. There is no, for example.
What can be done?
Internet, for example.
What can be done, Brother Yasser?
Look, we can't do anything because we do not run it. Mm-hmm. Certain countries have put certain restrictions on what the society can and cannot see. Even then, that's very easy to break. Very easy. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know it's very easy to break. But for example, you have. Things like Instagram or Twitter or these things, after pressure by certain individuals, certain things happen. But if the pressure was not there, what they call people's power, then nothing would have happened because it's, as they say, freedom of speech. So I have freedom of speech, whatever I put online, you have to let it go. Mm-hmm. Whether how bad it is, you have to let it go. This ethics of the internet or internet ethics or...
Yeah.
They call it techno-ethics. It's something that's coming.
Techno-ethics, yeah.
It's new. Because of these problems they found, it is something new. And from where?
And lots of other examples of child abuse on the internet.
Exactly.
And lots of people, lots of countries, in fact, are really against it and they act on it now.
Act on it. But for example, those who control the internet, like, we can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Even those particular websites and companies who are told, take these videos down, they're like, we checked it for validity content, for example. So this techno-ethics is something that is new. It needs to be dealt with.
Yes.
How far can you go with it is another story because internet is open. For example, you block one place,
yes.
it can open up somewhere else.
Yeah.
It's just a wormhole. So it's a very sharp double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly.
That, unfortunately, bad side is outweighing the good side.
Around the year 2000... we had a cyber interview, me and one of my friends actually, somewhere at another institute. Cyber ethics, yeah. We had a cyber interview with Bill Gates. It was very interesting. At the time, we didn't have this kind of internet like, as widespread as today, right? Internet was just coming to Iran and we just rushed to use it, And I was a subscriber to some of these inboxes and emails, And then we used this opportunity to interview Bill Gates. And we understood at the time his daughter was 16 years of age. And then he said that as the founder of Microsoft, as the founder of computer, basically PC, personal computers, we know how important he was in establishment of such technological facility, he said that I only allow my child, my daughter, 1 hour during a day to use the computer, like for recreational purposes. For a study, that's a different story, but for recreation, like games and stuff like this and that, only 1 hour. That was shocking to me. Like, this guy is the father of computer and he knows how double-edged sword it can be. We are talking about internet, computers, and stuff like that, right? Brother Ali Mohsen, can you talk about